It's my great honor to announce that we have successfully completed negotiations on a brand new deal to terminate and replace NAFTA and the NAFTA trade agreements with an incredible new U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement called USMCA. It sort of just works. MCA. USMCA. And that'll be the name, I guess, that 99% of the time we'll be hearing. USMCA. Has a good ring to it.
Welcome to the Security Perimeter, an apocalyptic podcast, starring my dad, Athanasios Christoulas. This is an awesome podcast, the best, guaranteed, 100%. We'll make Perimeter Podcast great again. My name is Lambro Christoulas, your announcer. And now, to my dad, Athanasios Christoulas, a.k.a. Saki.
So, yes, finally another Security Perimeter Podcast. I know, it's taken me forever to put these things together. It's tough. This one was a tough one because, I did it with infamous, Duncan Wood, director of the Mexico Institute, the Wilson Center. And we were trying to get together to discuss North America in the context of all the changes that have been taking place with the negotiations and blah, 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 blah. And things just kept on evolving and changing. So we actually had to re-record the podcast a few times. So I really want to thank Duncan for for taking the time to do this, because it is a theme that has been evolving and changing constantly. And Duncan was nice enough to come back and redo the podcast. And probably imagine the podcast is on the new free trade agreement referred to as the USMCA, United States-Mexico-Canada Free Trade Agreement. The horrible NAFTA agreement is now gone and has been replaced by the beautiful USMCA agreement negotiated by the Donald. You can do USMCA, but you can also do, if you think about it, move the letters around a little bit, you can make it into SMAC. So I'm going to be referring to the free trade agreement from now on as the SMAC agreement. So without further ado, the famous, infamous Duncan Wood on the new SMAC agreement. And I know there are a lot of you ex-aluminos out there that are going to be really excited to listen to what Duncan has to say about the new agreement. It's actually a little surprising. I thought he'd be a little bit more upbeat about it. In fact, he's not. And he identifies a number of problems with the agreement, which hadn't occurred to me. And it's a darn good thing I did the interview with Duncan, because now I'm a smarter man. Duncan, thank you for being on the Security Perimeter Podcast, and this is a really, really good time to be speaking to you because this week, the new NAFTA agreement, and I guess I can't really call it that, it's called the USMCA agreement. They even took away the word trade, right?
Yeah, it's interesting that NAFTA obviously was the North American Free Trade Agreement. It seems as though the American administration of Donald Trump doesn't like to use the words free trade. They prefer fair trade, of course. USMCA is not nearly as elegant. The Mexicans have found a way of saying it's much more easily. They call it the AMEC, the Acuerdo México Estados Unidos Canadá. And so sometimes I'll use that, but the really problematical thing is that if you try to turn it into a word, it comes out as USMACA. And nobody wants to use that at this particular point in history. We've got this new agreement. It is a significant achievement. We've managed to save North American free trade. But in the process of doing so, and we can talk about this at length in a second, but in the process of saving North American free trade, we've actually compromised some of the principles of free trade. And we have set precedents that will be very, very important in future trading agreements between the United States and other countries out there in the world. And actually has embedded within the new agreement some principles that really are really anti-trade or anti-free trade. So, you know, this is a partial victory for free traders, but they've lost something as well. It is a good treaty or agreement in the sense that it has come up, it has modernized the language of the old NAFTA. We've incorporated a lot of the principles that were negotiated in the TPP. We've brought in new issues such as digital trade, e-commerce, etc. But we've taken a step back. We've increased regional content. We've included the concept of salary-based measures for determining content, and we've weakened some of the dispute settlement mechanisms. So, you know, it's a mixed bag, to be honest with you.
Now, is this the and forgive my ignorance, is this the trilateral version, or the would you have said this about the bilateral Mexico U.S. Version that was signed a few weeks ago?
So it is an important and interesting question you ask, because the trilateral agreement has some elements which are bilateral within it. And so the bilateral deal that was signed between the United States and Mexico, some of that has found its way, or a lot of the text has found its way through into the trilateral agreement. And some of that text only applies to the United States and Mexico. In particular, you know, the one that really matters the most is the dispute settlement mechanism for investor-state disputes, whereby in the old treaty, in the old agreement, any one of the three countries was forced to provide dispute settlement resolution through a NAFTA panel if there was, in the event of a dispute between an investor and the host state. In the new agreement, it's only in the case of U.S.-Mexico relations. So, you know, Canada isn't part of it.
Is that something the Canadians wanted? Not to be part of it,
Not particularly bothered with it, but the Mexicans insisted on keeping it.
Okay, well, but why wouldn't the Canadians think it's an important?
This is a particularly important thing if you have a country where the courts don't work properly. So if you have a reliable judicial system, as you do in the United States and Canada, then you're quite happy to take disputes to the national courts. However, in the case of Mexico, which does not have that, it's very important to have an independent dispute settlement mechanism in place.
Makes sense. Yeah, okay. But what about there like two or three different types of dispute mechanisms? Do you want to go through them? What still exists, exist? What's been modified?
Yeah, there's the state-to-state dispute settlement mechanism where, you know, the countries can, dispute the implementation of the rules, etc. That was what was Chapter 20 in the old NAFTA. Yeah. That remains. Some of the language has been modernized, but it remains pretty much the same. The most important one, however, for Canada was Chapter 19 of the old agreement, which was to do with anti-dumping practices. And Canada was particularly sensitive to this because the United States has repeatedly accused Canada of dumping products into the U.S. market. And
this
Canada
is the whole
says, well,
thing, right? Is this the whole lumber?
It's a lot to do with, softwood lumber and other products. And Canada wants to have an independent tribunal where it can go and appeal its case rather than the United States saying, you're dumping, which means that we can take retaliatory measures. So that was a red line issue for Canada from day one. There was actually it goes way back to the original Canada-U.S. Free Trade Agreement. When that was being negotiated, the United States didn't want to include it, and Canada actually walked away from the table, forcing the United States to accept it, and that got passed into the NAFTA. And this time around, the United States wanted to get rid of it. They didn't like that, and Canada insisted, wait until the very last minute before signing onto the agreement, and in exchange, got the Chapter 19 provisions into the new agreement.
Chapter 19 exists also for the, my ignorance, right? Does this also apply in the case of Mexico, U.S.?
Yes.
Okay,
Okay. Yeah, this is a trilateral deal.
Is it a trilateral deal or two bilateral deals?
It's a trilateral deal, but not all parties are subject to all of its provisions. So the comparison to make is this. In the original NAFTA, there was an energy chapter, but Mexico was excluded from some of its provisions because Mexico had a closed energy sector at the time that was run through state monopolies. And so what they've done this time around is something similar, where Mexico is part of it on some things and not, and Canada doesn't appear there.
Okay, so there is precedent for this, right? I mean, that's not...
It's not that unusual. Let's talk about, first of all, I mean, a couple of issues. One being the automobile sector, then secondly, the sunset clause.
Yeah, what's up with that? Yeah.
And thirdly, the question of non-market economies. So on the automobile sector, this is... obviously, it was... That's the heart of the agreement, because the automobile industry is so crucial to maintaining integrated supply chains in North America. So the difference between the USMCA and the original NAFTA is that in the original NAFTA, to qualify as a North American car, a vehicle needed to have 62.5% of its content coming from within the three countries of North America.
Okay.
In the new agreement, it's now 75%. Now, that's a significant jump up. It's less than the United States wanted. They were originally pushing for 85% North American content. The industry pushed back and said that we can't do that. And so they settled on 75%. But even with 75%, this means that costs are probably going to go up for the North American consumer, because the automobile manufacturers are now going to have to move some of their overseas production, that is outside of the North American region, back to North America. Things that are currently being done more efficiently at lower cost in Asia, in Europe, et cetera, will have to be moved here. And the cost of that will be passed on to the consumer.
Okay.
It's good news, of course, for
North America, right?
And but for it's workers not... within the region, yes. But the consumer will pay the price. The second element of the...
Hold on a sec. So is this an example? Is this an example of something what you mentioned in the beginning, which was like this is a kind of anti-free trade agreement in the sense that they're going to strengthen the productive capacity of North America. They're going to increase it, and that's going to make North America stronger, but at the same time expensive. But at the same time, it's like non-free trade, because the obvious thing to do is to buy the pieces from the cheapest supplier. Is that an example of what you were trying to get at?
Yeah, my colleague from McClarty Associates, Kelly Myman, likes to make the comparison with Brazil's national content requirements, which, Brazil insists that if a product is to count as a national product, then it has to have a certain amount of its content coming from within Brazil. And that tends to raise the cost of the product, which means that Brazilian consumers end up paying a much higher price for cars and other manufactured goods than their counterparts in Mexico, the United States, or Canada. So by raising the regional content requirement, it is good for production. It's good for employment. But there is a cost that gets passed on to the consumer. And, of course, the other element of this is to do with the minimum salary requirement, which is that in the new agreement, between 40 to 45% of a North American vehicle, if it's to qualify as a North American vehicle under the new agreement, between 40 to 45% of that, the content of that vehicle has to come from factories where they pay an average of $16 an hour in wages.
Okay.
Now, clearly, that's not, Mexican factories don't pay $16 an hour.
How much do they pay, by the way?
It depends. I mean, there's a great deal of variation. But you would expect that wages are going to come somewhere in the, maybe in the $25 to $30 a day. So, that's a good salary in Mexico. That's really not bad.
It's a decent salary, yeah.
And of course, it depends on the worker's skill level. But this is a very important thing, because it means that 40 to 45% of the content of a vehicle has to be produced either in Canada or the United States. Now, for most vehicle models, that's not a problem, because that's already the case. Between 40 and 45% is produced in Canada or the United States. But in some of the smaller cars that are sold in the North American market, The Japanese models, some of the European models. That is not the case, which means that some of that production is either going to have to be moved back to the United States, which is implies another cost because, wages will go up and therefore the cost of production will go up. Or alternatively, those cars will no longer count as North American cars. And if they want to enter the market of the United States, then they would have to pay the WTO Most Favored Nation tariff, which is 2.5%. And I suspect that a number of car companies are going to make that decision that at least in the short to medium term, they'll pay the 2.5% tariff to get into the U.S. market rather than move production, rather than try to change the mix of salaries within the production process.
So, but Mexico did sign on to this idea about having a $16 salary, right? And but the problem is what we had discussed previously, which was, I mean, how do you calculate the $16, right? I mean, how do you spread it across the entire company, or is it only the workers? And might there be a way for the Mexicans to be able to demonstrate that, hey, look, we're doing the $16?
Yeah, I think it's going to be very difficult for them to do that. The calculation that there are certain elements of the production process which are included in the calculation. So, for example, the design element is included in there, which helps a great deal because, of course, auto designers get paid a lot more than $16 an hour. And so you're looking for you can calculate their salary into the average of the factory salary. But those designers tend to be based in the United States, not in Mexico. So that, again, that helps the United States to satisfy the 40 to 45% of the content coming from people with an average of $16 an hour, but it's probably not going to help the Mexican counterparts.
That's something that might actually hurt Mexico significantly, isn't it? Or at least 2.5% per automobile.
Yes, it could do. As I said, in most vehicle models, it's fine because already 40 to 45% is produced in the United States and Canada combined. There will be some models where that's not the case.
Okay.
I mean, the second big problem that I see in this new agreement is the sunset clause. In the original bargaining position put forward by the United States Trade Representative, there was a proposal for a five-year sunset clause, which meant that after 5 years, unless the three parties agreed to extend the life of the NAFTA or of the new agreement, then it would automatically expire. And there was huge pushback against this, both from Mexico and Canada and from the investor community, saying that didn't give any kind of investment certainty. So in the final calculation, the sunset clause is now a 16-year sunset clause. Which is a decent amount of time. It's equivalent to four U.S. administrations, it's a pretty long period of time for investors to say, well, if I invest, at least I've got 16 years. But to make it even better, there is a six-year review mechanism. If after 6 years the three parties agree that everything's going well, then it's extended for another 16 years. So every 6 years, we're going to go through a moment of reckoning where we evaluate how successful the North American, the USMCA has been. Yeah. And if the three governments say it all looks good, then it gets renewed for another 16 years.
But hold on, what's the difference between the six-year one and the 16-year one?
So if after 6 years, one of the parties says we don't like it, then 10 years after that, the treaty will expire. So it's 6 years within a 16-year period, okay? And of course, that gives 10 years for minds to be changed and administrations to be changed as well. Now, the problem that I see with a sunset clause is the principle of a sunset clause. An element that, you want to sign a free trade agreement because you believe that free trade is good. And yes, it's fine to have a review mechanism so that you can fix problems. But you don't really want to hold the threat of termination over the heads of your partners. But that's very much been a strategy, or a tactic rather, of the Trump administration, is that you threaten withdrawal, you threaten termination in order to get more concessions.
And, you know, if I can, the final problem that I see with the agreement is in Chapter 32, which is exceptions and general provisions. And in that, they talk about free trade agreements with non-market economies. And under this provision, NMEs.
What is a non-market economy?
Well, a non-market
I'm not an IPE guy, so.
A non-market economy would be something like Cuba. You could make the argument North Korea. You could say maybe Venezuela.
Right. Okay.
But most importantly, you say China. China.
Right.
This is directed against China. So any member who plans to launch a trade negotiations with a non-market economy, China, has to give the other two members at least a 3 months notice prior to starting the negotiations. And if that free trade agreement is signed, then the other two members can terminate the agreement, the original USMCA agreement. So Chapter 32 stipulates that if a member of the USMCA plans to launch trade negotiations with a non-market economy, it has to give the other two members at least 3 months' notice prior to starting the negotiations. And if it ends up signing a free trade agreement with that non-market economy, i.e. China, then the other two members can terminate the USMCA. Now, that's very, very important, because what the United States is threatening there is that
Mexico, immediately?
They can terminate. I think they have to give something like 6 months' notice.
Okay.
Okay?
Wow.
So, this is a reason to terminate the agreement. Now, this is a way of the United States threatening Mexico and Canada, saying to them, if you decide to sign a free trade agreement with China, you lose a free trade agreement with the United States. In other words, this is the United States trying to isolate China from Mexico and Canada. And most importantly, this stipulation is probably going to be included in all future United States FTAs. So the United States will take this example, it'll put it into a free trade agreement that it will sign with Europe, it'll put it into a free trade agreement that it signs with Japan, because its its goal here is to isolate China from the market economies.
Well, I mean, in a way, you know, the Chinese do cheat, right? So the American consumer benefits from that cheating and manipulation of their currency and semi-dumping and stuff like that. But that's a pretty bully tactic, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and it's a bit like the Helms-Burton law. It's trying to extraterritorialize American preferences. Now, it's different because, of course, the other two countries in this case have agreed to do this, but they've agreed under duress. You know, very similar to that is there is a provision in the new treaty on currency manipulation.
Hold on a second. This is going to affect the Canadians much more than the Mexicans, because from what I understand, the Mexicans aren't doing that much business with the Chinese, but the Canadians are in the process of at least trying to increase the amount of trade with China, right?
Yes. Now, it doesn't say that you can't trade with China. It just says you can't sign an FTA with China.
Ah, okay.
So, that's not a crazy situation. You know, both Canada and Mexico are trying to diversify their trading relations after the trauma of the renegotiating of NAFTA. And so, both of them have been looking at that, and a free trade agreement with China was not a crazy idea. However, now it's kind of off the table, at least as long as President Trump is in the White House.
So are the Mexicans and the Canadians kind of okay with this?
They were willing to make that sacrifice or that concession in order to get a deal. In Chapter 33, which talks about macroeconomic policies and exchange rate matters, there is a stipulation that the member countries have to maintain market-determined exchange rates. They have to refrain from competitive devaluations of their currencies and they strengthen the conditions for macroeconomic and exchange rate stability. That all sounds absolutely fine. But yeah. The reason why the United States has insisted on including this is not because Canada or Mexico have a history of manipulating their currency values, but because the United States wants to get it established as a precedent so that in all future FTAs, there will be a currency chapter. So the Japanese are now aware that if they negotiate an FTA with the United States, they will be subject to restrictions mm-hmm. on manipulating their currency values. And of course, the United States has repeatedly accused China of currency manipulation in order to right. gain a competitive advantage. So this is a
but not the are the Japanese. I didn't think the Japanese are the types who would manipulate their currency. Were they? Are they?
In many cases over the past 30 years, Japan has been accused by the United States of currency manipulation.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
So, I mean, what all of these problems are that I see in this treaty is that this is a, you know, it's this peculiar mixture between, yes, we've continued the free trade principles of the NAFTA. Yes, we've updated the language to incorporate some of the new ideas that were negotiated in the Trans-Pacific Partnership or TPP. But we've also mm-hmm. got these elements which are either about limiting free trade and free movement, or they're mm-hmm. about putting in new conditions that the United States will then take out there into the world. So, you know, as mm-hmm. much as anything, particularly this question of the non-market economies, the United mm-hmm. States is really using trade agreements now as a tool of broader foreign policy.
Can you tell me something good about the agreement?
Well, I mean, the good news is that we have an agreement. You know, you're looking at a level of trade in North America between the three nations of more than $1.2 trillion a year. You know, it's more than $2 million a minute across the borders of North America. So you've managed to save that market. And trade between the North American partners will continue and will continue to grow. So that's the good news. I would say that it is a step forward in many regards, which is that, you know, we have improved protections on labor and on environment. That's very good. Mm. We've included new issues like digital trade.
On the environment thing, I'm sure a lot of the listeners are going to want to hear a little bit about that. I don't know if you know some details about that.
So on both environment and labor, what we've seen is that, you know, in the original NAFTA, those two issues were not part of the agreement. They were actually side agreements that were put in place afterwards as President Bill Clinton needed to get congressional support for the agreement. He negotiated with Canada and Mexico to sign side agreements. Now, in this case, labor and environmental protections are included within the text of the USMCA, and they are enforceable, whereas the side agreements were really not enforceable. They were more like guidelines. So this means that the higher standards, and there are some very interesting things in there on labor that require Mexico, for example, to guarantee collective bargaining power for workers in Mexican factories. You know, these are things that in the six-year review mechanism, for example, that you can come and say, well, you haven't done that, so, you know, we are potentially going to withdraw from this agreement. So you have that kind of thing. Now, on environment, what we've seen is that very much the kind of language that was included in the TPP has now been applied to the USMCA. And again, these are environmental standards requiring regulations, et cetera, basically preventing a country like Mexico from using weaker environmental regulations to attract investment. Now there's a way in which you can actually, Mexico will have liability if it does that. So these are actually good things and important elements of a 21st century free trade agreement. And then, of course, the big issue of digital trade, which is a very, very important thing. I mean, digital trade is all about, you know, electronically distributed products such as e-books, videos, music software, etc. And these are now customs free. That you don't pay duty on those. So if you are a customer in Mexico and you buy an e-book from an online retailer in the United States, That comes to you duty-free, which is a very, very important thing, because it's a huge and growing economy. Data has to be allowed to be transferred cross-border, and there are very few limits now on where data needs to be stored. And that's an important point, because if you're thinking about the expansion of financial services, for example, from the United States or Canada into Mexico, or even from Mexico into the United States, you know, they want to be able to store their data wherever that makes most sense for them to do it, rather than having to create an entirely new database in the country where they're doing business. And related to digital trade is, of course, e-commerce. E-commerce has been such an important development since the negotiation of the original NAFTA. And one of the big differences between the United States on one side and Canada and Mexico on the other is that the United States has a very high de minimis level, which means de minimis is the minimum cost or price of goods entering the country where they have to pay duties or customs. The United States had, has an $800 level. So if something is crossing the border, if it's worth less than $800, it doesn't pay duty. Okay.
Right.
Whereas
what is it in Canada, Mexico,
they had much, much lower standards than that. So what the United States managed to negotiate with Canada and Mexico is that they would double their existing de minimis levels, which will help goods. For example, if you buy a T-shirt or a hat from Amazon in the United States to come into Mexico, and if it costs less than, I think the new level is something like $50, then it'll get in duty free. So these are all good positive things that will actually help the free trading environment in North America.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, was it all worth it? I mean, you know, we've been through this entire process. If we go back to inauguration, then we've been at this for 20 months. If we go back to the launching of NAFTA renegotiations in August of last year, then we've been at this for 14 months. And along the way, there's been a significant amount of collateral damage. You know, trust in the U.S. government from Mexican to Canadian has been diminished greatly. We have seen, enormous stresses and strains. We've seen uncertainty in the market. We've seen investors holding back on putting money into North America because they wanted to see how all of this was going to be resolved. Was it worth it? And I think that the jury is very much out on that. My favorite...
Has North America been hurt by this economically?
I think that, anecdotally, we know that companies have held back on investments they would have made otherwise.
Is that right?
Okay. Yeah. So, the economies of North America are doing well right now, but they could have been doing even better if this hadn't been the case. But my favorite cartoon of the past week was actually... a set of five building blocks, one on top of the other one. They spell out trade. Along comes President Trump, and he pushes over the blocks. The next picture is of the various trade representatives of the three countries, the economy ministers, coming together and rebuilding the blocks, putting them on top of each other. And the last picture is of President Trump standing beside them, fingers raised in victory. He created a problem and fixed it. And the question is, why did we create that problem in the first place? Now, another way of
you and other people had said that NAFTA, and this is even before Trump, that a lot of people were saying that NAFTA had to be updated.
So that's the other point of view, is to say that, many of us have been saying for a number of years that NAFTA was an old lady of free trade agreements, and it needed to be modernized, it needed to be updated. And what President Trump managed to do in his style of being a great disruptor was that he forced everybody to come to the table, and he forced us to renegotiate and to put in place a more modern 21st century free trade agreement. So that's the more optimistic take on it. Certainly I think that there are things that have happened over the past 14 months that would not have happened without Trump as president. So, whether or not this makes it worth it in terms of the political fallout, whether or not it makes it worth it in terms of the investor uncertainty is another question, but at least we do have a new agreement.
One last thing, Dunk. I was reading something just, I think, yesterday that was saying that this thing is not going to pass Congress in before the election. Is that right, or is this article completely wrong?
Well, there's a number of scenarios here, but you know, one of them is that it's going to be very difficult to get it onto the docket before Christmas, and so it's likely that in fact the new Congress, which comes in January, voted in November, but comes into office in January, that will be the Congress that actually ratifies or not the agreement. But there's another scenario, and that is that President Trump basically pushes the issue and forces Congress to vote on it in the lame duck session. And one way that he could do that is, again, by using the threat of NAFTA termination. If he just simply terminates NAFTA, he says, tomorrow, the United States is withdrawing from NAFTA. It's dead because we've got another free trade agreement. How does Congress not vote for it? Like, he will basically light a fire under the feet of congressmen and women, and they will feel a greater sense of urgency.
Okay, one last question. I'm sorry, man. It's a quick one, maybe even a funny one. So nobody was expecting that they would get this thing done by the 30th of September, and they did it. And my question is, who blinked?
It's a very good question. So I actually think that the major holdout issue at the end was that that Chapter 19 dispute settlement mechanism, okay, the anti-dumping thing, all right, which is now incorporated into Chapter 10, okay, of the new agreement. And in this one, Canada insisted, it would not give it up, and in the end, the United States said, fine, we'll let you keep it. In exchange, Canada was willing to give up certain things, most importantly on the question of access to Canada's dairy market. But I get the feeling by speaking to people along the way that Canada was always willing to make a concession on dairy. So I think that Canada actually did a good job. Now, that's the question on U.S.-Canada. On U.S.-Mexico, I think that Mexico may have blinked earlier on. You know, they came to an agreement with the United States by the end of August, and I think that they ended up making certain concessions that they wouldn't necessarily have wanted to, but they thought were necessary in order to get the agreement.
Huh. Dunk, thank you, my friend.
You're welcome. Good luck with the rest of the podcast, and have a great weekend.
Yeah, you too. I hope you have some fun plans for the weekend with your lovely wife.
Thanks a lot, man. All the best. We'll talk to you soon, okay?
All the best. Yes. Take care. Bye-bye. I'm giving you a night call to tell you how I feel. I want to drive you through the night, down the hills. I gotta tell you something you don't want to hear. Show you where it's dark, but have no fear. There's something inside you, it's hard to explain. They're talking about you, boy, but you're still the same. There's something inside you, it's hard to explain. They're talking about you, boy, but you're still the same. I'm giving you a night call to tell you how I feel. I want to drive you through the night, down the hills. I gotta tell you something you don't want to hear. I'm gonna show you where it's dark, but have no fear.
But you're still the same.